From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I've been digging into a diverse and compelling collection of essays in a recent book that's centered on the subject of flowers. Everything from topics like their breeding, to which species we covet most of all, to some of the downsides of the massive floral industry, including ubiquitous plastics used in propagation and flower arranging, or how the branding of plants has limited the palate. The author, Kristen Giel, calls the book Flora Culture: How Flowers Shape Our World. An ABCDarium, yes, that's a word, since the entries are arranged alphabetically. She also calls it a manifesto. She's here today to tell us some of the tales within it, so more in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Kristen Giel's work focuses on the intersections of nature, culture, and horticulture, and her latest book, Flora Culture: How Flowers Shape Our World, is no exception. I'm glad to welcome her to the program today. Hi, Kristen, how are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. It's a very unusual book, and as I said, it's an ABCDarium. Which just, I don't know why, it just cracks me up, that word. I've never seen it in print before, and I love that, which means that it's arranged in alphabet. The entries, each of the essays starts with, a word with the title has, corresponds to the letter of the alphabet, and they're in order.
85 of them.
Yes, more than the letters in the alphabet.
Yes.
Yes. But before we get started, I'll say we'll have a book giveaway with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com. And just, you know, so to start, really, maybe some backstory, because this is not exactly a book about cut flowers. And I say that, I sort of realize it actually recalls a funny exchange that you note in the book that you had with your publisher. So tell us about that and tell us what the book is about, you know, its intention.
Well, I did submit the manuscript, and the publisher at Rizzoli said, wait a minute, I thought this book was about floral design. And one of the critiques was there were too many people in the book. And the argument there is that people in gardening books, you know, date the book in terms of the clothing they're wearing and so on. And I thought to myself, well, wait a minute, like cultivars date books. You know, you and I have definitely seen fashions come and go in terms of plants and garden styles. That was an element that I was playing with throughout the book, which was fashion. And I wanted the book to be really visually compelling. So there are over 250 images, and it's very colorful. In order to add some levity to actually some very serious topics.
Yes. 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 And a lot of those, some of the more serious ones, sort of touch on the kind of massive industry behind our cut flowers and also our garden plants. You know, how its evolution has changed, as I said in the introduction, you know, the plant palette and more impacts that it's had. Before we get to that, you know, you mentioned in the book that some flowers have had enduring affection from humans, like tulips and roses, I think, are sort of on top of the hit parade. They've had enduring affection. Is that correct?
They have. Yes, that's right. In part because of how they have featured in Western art. And looking at art history and horticultural history, there's often some interesting overlaps. Of course, we all know about tulipomania in the 17th century in Holland, but you know, those flowers appear again and again, in part because we have seen them made beautiful as opposed to some other plants.
Right.
Yes.
But then, to get back to sort of the industry thing, using tulips, for instance, as an example, to grow a cut tulip, and actually for most people to grow the tulips that they grow for bedding out, quote unquote, to use an old-fashioned term, actually bedding out, but they use for spring color in their gardens. A lot of times they toss them after one use. Yeah, so it fuels
Yeah,
an
it's not really
industry.
a sustainable industry, the tulip industry. It
Right.
takes a grower, 2 to 3 years to get a saleable bulb. And with some of the modern cultivars, they're really meant to just be a one and done plant, and it's more economically viable for a grower to actually toss them on the compost heap than to you lose the space in their plot. To try and see if they'll rebloom, because they likely won't.
Right.
So, there are ways around that for home gardeners, looking to species tulips, or even some of the Darwin hybrids are better. But it's a also, climate has something to do with it as well. But now tulips are almost like disposable flowers.
And that's what I was getting at,
Yeah.
and that's what you get at in the book, that it's not, the goal has not been to make them perennialize or anything like that. It's,
No.
there's a formula that makes it work for the industry, and it's become a commodity item that we buy both for cut flowers in the florist shop or whatever, and for as gardeners, year after year after year. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there has been some movement to support local growers and make the tulip the new rose for Valentine's Day by forcing tulips in heated greenhouses. They're sometimes grown in plastic crates and warmed up to get them to market. And I think this was in part one of the reasons that I wrote the book, is that everyone has been asking, well, like, what is the sustainable flower? What can we do? And it was worth leaning into some of these topics to find out, really, is supplying tulips in February a good idea in some climates? And I
Right.
think, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So under S in the book, you have
Yes.
an entry entitled Seasonality, and you underscore that despite expressions like to everything there is a season, just what you just spoke about with tulips in February, the floral industry in particular is contra-seasonal, is the word you use. Lots of untimely things, you say.
Lots of untimely things, yes. And I learned that some florists aren't actually trained in true seasonality. They might be trained in what is the season at the flower market.
Right.
So proteas will show up in the New York flower market in September, let's say. So that might be protea season for a floral designer, or Japanese sweet pea season, or certain ranunculuses now almost all the time, but d certain flowers, it's when they come to market. And that's
Yes.
one of the impacts of globalization, is that people don't really have a sense of true seasonality.
Yes, and I hadn't really, I knew that, but I hadn't really thought of it that way.
We, a lot
Yeah.
of this we think about in terms of food. I think that
Yes.
many of us have, so much work has gone into food and sustainable food production and local food production, but not as much attention as has come into, I'd say, horticulture and floriculture.
Right.
Yeah, so that was my
Yeah.
goal. Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about under B for breeding.
Yes.
So I have to say, just as a preface to talking about sort of plant breeding and so forth, I have to say, and this is not just about cut flowers, but garden plants as well, annuals, quote unquote, or for that matter, perennials, et cetera. I have to say, I get kind of depressed at the garden center these days. I was spoiled back in the day years ago when there were lots more sort of specialty retail nurseries run by real plant nuts, and they each had a particular passion, and you'd go to so and so because he was really into this or that, and so the other person, she was into the, and it was a different type of shopping. And now there's sort of, no matter where you go, there's like row after row, tray after tray, rack after rack of branded stuff, often the same at every place. And then in a few years, I know that if I do find one, like I find a heuchera that I really like, 3 or 5 years from now, it probably won't be featured anymore in the
That
assortment.
is absolutely
Oh,
true.
and
I know
it's
the
just,
feeling. Yeah,
yes.
I know the feeling. And I have epigraphs for every essay in the book, so I had to find 85 epigraphs, so this was fun. But that one of them is fashion is the leading edge of planned obsolescence. So,
Yes.
that the fact that you can't find that hooker anymore is somewhat intentional, but also some of those cult of art, those hookers don't act, some of them don't actually last anyway, or maybe not long enough. But yeah, it's fascinating. The modern garden center, 40% of the plants on display might be owned by one corporation. One Ball Horticulture would be one of them that have other businesses under them. Some of these companies are vertically integrated, so they're supplying seed. They're also, growing the plants. They're branding the plants. They're doing the marketing, and really, the breeders now are just kind of, to quote this geneticist that I learned from in the book, is that they're just sort of spinning the color wheel and sort of doling out new varieties to reliable mainstays. So we'll see. Different colors of petunias or different colors of geraniums, and down we go. And it's generally the same genera that are presented, just in slightly different forms and colors.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's interesting. It's again, I had more fun when in the early days of my gardening career when I was another other like-minded nuts like myself, who obsessed over things and wanted to find the wackiest one or the most unusual one. And do you know what I mean? It wasn't mass produced, but
There still are some nurseries like that, though.
absolutely.
Yeah,
But
yeah.
not even within
Or
2 hours.
clubs, right, where
Yeah.
people can
Right.
trade. Yeah,
Yes.
yeah.
But even within 2 hours of where I live, there were a half a dozen that no longer exist, that were well known. And do you know what I mean? I mean,
I
it's,
think it's hard to make
yeah.
a living at it. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, so it is a big business in a different way. And the breeding, and you just talked about the breeder, so the person who actually invents that hooker or whatever, who breeds it, who discovers it, might be getting a commission, but isn't producing it. I mean, right? I
Right.
mean,
They would
yes,
sell, they would license it, or they sell the rights to a company like Proven Winners. Yeah.
So it's just a whole different model.
It is.
Yeah,
Yeah. Yeah.
yeah,
Yeah.
yeah,
Yeah.
yeah. And I think, as you point out in the book, I think under C for cultivar, it's had an impact. The same thinking has an impact on food crops too. I think you say that it's estimated that about 75% of food crop varieties have been lost in the last century. Because there is this desire. I don't think you can patent. Can you patent a seed variety? I don't think you can. Can you?
Yes. Yes.
Is that
Yeah.
that's correct? You can't.
Yes.
Okay.
No, you can.
You can. Oh, okay, you
Yeah.
can. So,
So that's often the situation with the exploitation of genetic resources from the global south.
okay.
And I think we should step back to maybe one of the reasons why I wrote this book. I wrote a book prior called Cultivated: The Elements of Floral Style, a lot of European art history, color theory in that book. And I realized, like, oh, sort of like left out the impact of horticulture or design sensibilities on, the developing world or the global south. And so in this book, I really want to bring some attention to that, because I'd also seen, a real, in this grown, not flown movement, a real denial of some of the benefits of using some tropical flowers as well. Sorry, I just jumped topics there, but I jumped topics there, but yes.
Yeah, and with the seeds, I think I should have said, like, of the ones that have dropped out of use, the food crops varieties have been lost in the last century. They're probably open pollinated, which
Yes.
is why you can't They're not patented. They're open pollinated varieties, probably.
Yeah,
A
it's
lot
really
of
about
them.
losing these land races, that
Yes,
have been created over millennia that are adapted to certain environments.
So I misspoke, but the intention was to say that as opposed. So it's had widespread impact in not just floriculture, but and in bedding plants and so forth, but
Yeah, I
elsewhere
think
as
many
well.
of us feel like the diversity is somewhat gone from the garden center now. And, that's another reason as well is, fewer people are growing from seed or necessarily saving seed or trading seed than 100 years ago.
And then there's these other costs, and I hinted at them, or issues. I hinted at them in the introduction. I found it fascinating. You delved into kind of microplastics and the words like biodegradable and bioplastics, but we don't even really understand what those mean, I don't think, in a lot of cases. The industry, both the floriculture, the cut flower industry, and the garden industry use a lot of plastics of various kinds. And I mean, just that one, you cited one statistic. I think you quoted the Financial Times that calculated that approximately 15,000 metric tons of floral foam, which is equivalent, you said, to 2.5 billion plastic bags, is sent to the landfill annually by flower lovers. So, just floral foam alone. I mean, forget all the other stuff. That's
Oh, and floral foam is sort of even a darker substance because it actually, does crumble and does sort of turn into very, very tiny, tiny pieces. So microplastics. There is room for hope. The Royal Horticultural Society in England has banned it. There isn't any at the Chelsea Flower Show or any of their shows. People are finding other ways to support flowers. There's a movement also in England to, work with churches about changing their expectations about how flowers can appear in sacred spaces, because often it's a venue that will have a regulation about spilled water or whatever, and people know that Oasis Floral Foam, sorry to say the big bad name, is one way that a venue won't have their floors damaged or whatever. But people are finding different ways now and returning to the pre-plastic period, which wasn't very long ago. This was really only invented in the 50s, I think it was.
And so, my grandmother had a collection of flower frogs and, metal and glass flower frogs, right? And I have them, and they're perfectly good, and they do the job, right? So what the heck? And they last forever. Sarah Raven, the British cut flower expert, I interviewed her for a New York Times column not long ago, and she was talking about this issue. And then she makes these little grids out of twigs, tied with kind of a special kind of almost a little bit stretchy twine at the joints, like it just looks like a grid, like a tic-tac-toe board, and they sit on top of different sized vessels, a bowl or a vase or whatever, and they service the frog, and they're reusable again, so many times. And there's other ways to do it, right?
There are other ways to do it. The floral community really put a lot of energy into rethinking flower foam, and I fully support that. And I speak to the Garden Club of America groups often, and I think that would be a group that could move to a no flower foam, and that would have a huge impact, actually. So it's just a little behind here, I would say, compared to England.
And then I think you also noted that, like 10 or 15 years ago, the talk became, oh, we'll have biodegradable plastic things. And but what does biodegradable mean?
Well, that's really hazy. And
Apparently, I didn't know how hazy it was till I read it in your book.
it's quite hazy. So if something, there's a sustainable forestry movement out of Australia that's really has done the work on this. And some of these bioplastics do need they need to be incinerated at high temperatures. Well, those kind of facilities don't really exist for everyone. When it says it's biodegradable, like how is it biodegradable? Does that mean I can put it in my compost heap? No, it means it might need some special treatment to actually biodegrade. So we'll see.
Yeah. And I think you said, is it going to take 10,000 years? Maybe in 10,000 years it's biodegradable or whatever. Well, that's not exactly what people think it means, So
One
it's
of
a little
the,
greenwashy, isn't it? Isn't
it
it?
is quite greenwashy. And that was one of the driving things behind writing the book is that there were all these conversations going on, and I didn't feel that these words, many of them were quite slippery, footprint, sustainable, and so on, needed some definition or context so that everyone could be speaking a similar language so that we could move forward on some of these things.
And just so that people are listening, they don't think, oh, these two women, they really hate plants or they're
Oh
really
my
anti the
God.
industry, because quite to the contrary, we're both quite passionate
Yeah.
about it, and that's not the point here at all.
No, the book, I think it's quite joyful, because there's a lot of hope in it. And there are also interludes about art or design or, modernism or orchids or, other things as well. It's we're picking some sort of the hot topics right now. And we haven't actually even kind of gotten to aesthetics yet, but any conversation about art or plant or about horticulture for me is also about art in some way, not just ecology.
Well, in the last 3, 4 minutes, I just wanted to say there was lots of sort of oddball and fun and stuff about beauty, and just like you just said about aesthetics and so forth. And I mean, and then there were just funny things, like there was one under C for chromophobia, the fear of color, and the idea that vivid colors were considered at some points in time savage, And I thought, yeah, great, that's kind of fun.
Yeah, very fun. Very fun. Also tricky, tricky, how different colors are ascribed different qualities and how color is subjective and it's very cultural. And we sort of forget that as well. But it's important to be aware. And chromophobia, it's a term that I picked up from an artist who walked into an art collector's home with all these white walls and then began to meditate and wrote a very slim book on this subject about how color had been maligned or subjected to the foreign or the feminine or the infantile, and that sort of true art was sort of into this sort of line and form. So it's an opinion piece, but it's just worth exploring.
Well, and that's yeah, and there's lots of, again, there's just, I mean, head spinning number of possible topics. And you can just dip in. You don't have to read from page one to page whatever. You can just dip in and just have fun and, take a little adventure with
A little adventure. Yes, I did. I took about half of the pictures myself and had a wonderful time traveling for some of them, particularly to South Africa and some other places that related to my understanding of plants and how they're grown and how flowers are grown. But then I tried to source images from museums, galleries, artists, other photographers. To sort of not do a sort of bio book, like a book about me. I wanted to open the conversation and include other people in it. And it was a privilege to have that. But if I could highlight other designers or other artists, that was important to me. And I was grateful that Rizzoli gave me like a very good photo budget to go shopping with.
Yeah, and
Yeah.
it's beautiful. It's luscious. I mean, it's
Opulent.
definitely opulent, and not savage. Not so vivid
No.
that it's teasing you. But anyway, yeah, it's beautiful. Well, and as I said, what we'll do is we'll have a book giveaway with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com. And I'm so glad to speak to you, and I'm sure we're going to have to speak again because there's how many more? There's about 82 or 3 more that we haven't spoken about
That's
essays in the
true.
book.
That's
So that was
true.
really fun. So thank you very much, Kristen Gill. And the book again is Flora Culture: How Flowers Shape Our World. So it's been fun. Thanks.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for tuning in. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook on Instagram as at awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, HighMowingSeeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, WhiteFlowerFarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of AwayToGarden.com and RobinHoodRadio.com.